for that. Welcome, everybody, to our Motion Zoom channel, our third cheer of the day, triple header on this Thanksgiving. We figured we'd do the best. We Americans are too busy celebrating and eating turkey, and so we get an American who lives in Canada, so we can appreciate Thanksgiving. And really, it's a pleasure to welcome Rabbi Kropotkin, of course, is the senior rabbi, the rabbi at the Beit, B-A-Y-T, the major shul here in Toronto. He's the president of the Rabbinical Council of America. He wrote the book on the Kuzari. He served, I guess, from my perspective, he served as rabbi in Allentown, Pennsylvania, a city I've come to like very much, even though I've never been there. And it's a pleasure to welcome Rabbi Kropotkin. He's really one of the leading figures in Toronto Jewry and is really doing a remarkable job across in his shul and the community at large. And Rabbi, welcome back to Torah in Motion.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Kelman. Thank you for inviting me. And for those who are watching from the United States, happy Thanksgiving. And I hope this makes for a good dessert and doesn't give you any indigestion. And maybe you'll save some room for Shabbat for your appetites. Rabbi Kelman, there's only one thing you mentioned that I couldn't understand. Why do you like Allentown so much? I mean, I like it too, but I spent close to 7 years there.
Right, considering our son-in-law is from Allentown, and you and Rabbi Kertiner were the only two kosher eidim wedding, two kosher eidim at the wedding this summer in our backyard.
That's right. You just reminded me. And Mazel Tov on the recent wedding, and I was your son-in-law Ismail.
Yes, I know that. I know that.
Okay, very nice. Okay, many years ago. All right, so enough reminiscing, folks. We're here to learn some Divrei Torah on this weekly Parsha. And I just want to share with you, I have really two ideas that I'd like to share with you from two different parts of the Parsha. We'll see if we have time for the second, because the first idea in and of itself is really a self-contained project that we can expand upon. And I know that, especially now that I see Dr. Heppner on the line, we may engage in some conversation instead of in lieu of going to the second conversation. So let's, I want to share this pasuk with you from Shir HaShirim. Let me make sure that I'm going to share the screen with you. Okay, everyone see it, I hope. Okay. There's a pasuk in Shir HaShirim that states as follows: Al tiruni she'ani shachar choret. Do not look upon me, for I have blackened skin. She'zafatni hashamish, because I've been darkened by the sun. B'nei imi nicharuvi, my siblings provoked me. Samuni noteira et hakiramim, they charged me to watch over the other vineyards. Karmisha lilo natarti. And as a result, I had to neglect my own vineyard. Now, this is the Jewish people, so to speak, in this love poem. This is the Jewish people apparently speaking to God, the man in the story. The Jewish people form the woman in the story. And the woman says, I don't look pretty. And the man in the story says, you know, to the contrary, you're actually quite beautiful. But why is the woman in the story of Shir HaShirim, why does she feel that her skin has been blackened by the sun and she's ashamed to be looked upon? And what does it have to do with the fact that I've been charged to watch over the vineyard of my siblings and I had to neglect my own vineyard? So if we look at Shir HaShirim as a poem of the national history of the Jewish people, then there's one way of looking at it, which is that when the Jewish people are sent into exile, they are forced to look over the needs of others before taking care of their own needs. And this is how the Psikta Zutrata looks at it. And as a result of the Jewish people taking care of others in the Galut, they become sullied in some way, spiritually sullied, because of their surroundings and because of their efforts for others other than themselves. So if you take a look at the Psikta, which is in source number 2, which is a Midrash, Samuni no terata karamim, Samuni be'artzot hagoyim, I have been placed in the lands of the other nations. Ulevakesh rachamim al shlom artzam. Now listen to this line. The Medrash says, I have been tasked with praying for mercy for the welfare of other lands. Now, what does this mean? Well, you'll see. Kinyan Shenemar, as the prophet Jeremiah said, V'sha'alu et shalom ha'ir, asher higleiti etcham shama, ki bishloma yihyeh lachem shalom. You must pray for or petition the welfare or the peace of the city to which I have exiled you there, because when it is at peace, you will be at peace. Now, this pasuk in Jeremiah is cited by the halachic authorities, as well as referenced by the commentaries to the Mishnah and Pirkei Avot, Heve mitpalel bishloma shel malchut, that it is obligatory for a Jew to pray for the welfare of the government where he or she finds themselves living. And this is actually codified as halacha according to many halachic authorities such as the Magen Avraham. They say that it is halachically incumbent upon a Jew who lives in the diaspora to pray for the welfare of the government. And that's why in many batei kneisiyot, it's become a very, very time-held practice that we do a tefillah lishloma medina, that we do a prayer for the sake of the government. In the United States, we pray for the president and the vice president and the Senate and the Congress. And in Canada, we pray for the prime minister, all of our local politicians, the members of parliament, and so forth. It's based on this verse in Jeremiah. And the Medjur says that that's what the woman is saying, is that I have been placed in the lands of others, and I am forced to seek out the welfare, not of my people Israel, but rather the welfare of the country in which I find myself. The Israel mevakshim bishlom ha-malchut, u'mevakshim rachamim al arzot ha-goyim. And the Jewish people pray for the peace and welfare of their government, and they pray for mercy for the lands of the other nations. And as an example of this, we say, v'tein talu matar livracha, al pinei ha'adama. And why does the Midrash use that example, which appears in the Amidah, where we ask God to provide proper amounts of dew and rain as blessing for the land? Because as we know, especially this is the time of year when we should be thinking about it, if you live in Eretz Yisrael, you've already started saying v'tein talu matar livracha, because you're praying for the rainfall in Israel. But if you live outside of Eretz Yisrael, you're praying for rain in the diaspora based on the patterns of rain in Babylonia, not in the patterns of rain in Eretz Yisrael. So this is an example, says the Midrash, about how we know that Jews are consigned to pray for wherever they currently live. And the Midrash seems to be saying that that's actually regrettable. Because if we were living in Eretz Yisrael, we could pray for our own land. We could pray for our own people. But now that we're in the diaspora, we have no choice but to pray for the welfare of where we live. Because ultimately, we will be affected by whatever happens in the country that we call home currently. And finally, the Medrash says, Karmi Shali, Artzi Umalchuti, Lo Natarti. Unfortunately, I have not been able to look over my own vineyard, my own land, my own government. Why? Ki galinu mitocha ve'in melech ve'in sar. Because we've been exiled from the land of Israel. There is no king, there is no official, there is no protector of the land. And so according to this midrash, this pasuk is reflective of the national state of the Jewish people in the diaspora. I would venture to say that as we are entering the cusp of the Messianic age, we are slowly transitioning from the position of this Midrash, which tells us that whereas in earlier periods of Jewish history, we could only pray exclusively for the lands of the diaspora, now we say a tefillah both for the land in which we live, whether it's the US or Canada, but we also say a tefillah lishlom medinat Eretz Yisrael. Because today we can actually, in many ways, tend to the vineyard where we live and also tend to the vineyards of Eretz Yisrael. But the Medrash is perhaps saying even more than that, that I have become blackened in the process of praying for the welfare of another foreign government. blackened in the sense that I have been spiritually compromised in some way because of this, because of the fact that I'm living in the galut. So that is one approach to this pasuk. And you'll see in a moment what in the world this has to do with Parshat Vayetze. But I'd like to present you with two other commentaries in just a moment, two commentaries from the world of Chassidut, which look at this pasuk not so much as a reflection of the national state of the Jewish people, but rather as an individual, how an individual sometimes finds himself or herself becoming sullied or blackened because they have to watch over someone else's garden and not take care of their own garden. So Rav Zell Wolf Halevi of Zhytomyr, who was a student of the Maggid of Meserich, so he represents like the early period of Chassidut, the third generation of Chassidut. In his commentary to Shir HaShirim, he writes as follows. Bikan nirmaz muzhar va'azhara latzadik. Here, the author is providing a caution to the righteous person. And the concept of a tzaddik in Chassidus means something special. It means the person who is able to influence and bring down divine influence upon the flock of the Jews upon whom he is tasked to watch over. Hamazhir umitzaveh b'tov livnei amo hanil v'meilav. The tzaddik who is in charge of taking care of and admonishing and instructing all of the Jews who are under his care. Ma'od ma'od yistakel al dirachav. He has to be very careful because in the previous paragraphs, the Sefer Or HaMeir, which is what we're studying now, was talking about how great the role of the tzaddik is, because see how one person can be influential in the lives of so many other people. And what a privilege it is to be that tzaddik, to be that person who has the ability to transform other people's lives. But in this pasuk, he says, this pasuk tells us in this paragraph that the tzaddik is undergoing an occupational hazard. Because ulabilti yovad ma'alato va'avodato b'sibatam, because he's in danger of losing his own spiritual level by tending to others. Ka'asher einenu ra'ot ata, asher yomam v'layla nosim ba'ol masa'am umatanam, la'anot ma'ane l'chol echad ve'echad srichiyutam hamerubim. And we find this, the tzaddik of any group of chassidim or any group of Jews, many times has to bear the burden of so many other people and is distracted day and night with the needs of others. Uvein kach v'kach nifritu midveikato. And as a result, he loses some level of his attachments to the Almighty. Ki b'nei aliyah heim amu'atim, because after all, as the Talmud itself says, it is very rare to find a person who can always remain that on that lofty level. And he continues along that line, and he therefore says in the final sentence, "V'nimsa bekalhu la'anose ba'ol amo la'abed haderech shelo ba'atzma." It is very easy, therefore, he says, for someone who bears the yoke, someone who bears the burden of his people, to lose his own way. And that is the admonition that is taking place in this pasuk. That this pasuk is referring to the tzaddik who is doing God's work and he is taking care of his brethren and he is doing laudable work. But at the same time, he becomes blackened and sullied. It harkens back to that interchange between Moses and his disciple Joshua in Parshat Bahalotcha, where Joshua sees that there are other people who are gaining prophetic powers. And he says to Moshe Rabbeinu, Adoni Moshe Kila'im, my master Moshe, we can stop them from rivaling your prophecy if only we place upon them the tzorchei tzibur, the burdens of the community. Because once even a prophet has to undergo and endure the travails and the trials of communal labor, he will immediately lose his prophetic abilities. And this is the occupational hazard of the tzaddik. And that's the way the Or HaMeir understands this, what this pasuk is referring to. And finally, a 20th century Hasidic commentary of the Admor of Lebertov, who is from the Biala dynasty, who was killed in the Shoah. And he too has an interpretation which is similar to the previous one, but he provides a more negative approach to this, in that the pasuk is talking about someone who is inserting themselves inappropriately in other people's lives. And therefore, he says, if you take a look at this pasuk, Samuni no teira et akiramim, look at the Rashi Tevot of the words, Samuni no teira et akiramim. Take the first letters of each one of those four words, and what does it spell? Sin, Nun, Aleph, He. They placed me as watching the vineyards of over as to watch the vineyards of others. Right? That spells the word Sin'ah. It causes hatred. And if you look at the next four words, Karmi, Sheli, Lo Natarti, take a look at the first letters of these four words. It spells Kishalon, which means a stumbling block or something that causes the one's downfall. And he points this out. Rashi Tevot Sina Kishalon. Yesh lomar remez bazeh b'derech tzachut, perhaps. Ki bi'im ha'adam yit'arev bi'inyanei acherim goreim sin'a le'atzmo. If a person butts into other people's business, to tend to other people's gardens and to watch over other people's vineyards, he will draw sin'a upon himself. He'll provoke the ire of others for inserting himself in other people's business. And also, this will cause a downfall for him. Ve'alder shekatu machazik be'ozne kelev mit'aver al-riv lo-lo. That he who grabs the ears of a dog is fighting a fight that he shouldn't be fighting. In other words, sometimes if you see a rabid dog, you should just walk the other way. You see a coyote or a wolf on the other side of the street, walk away. Don't go over and insert yourself in that person's business. The gam yitachen lomar, sheze ba lerov misina el acherim, ba levaker ma'asehem, ki ilu hu na'ase l'shomer l'karmehem. And many times the word sina is an allusion to the fact that, you know why people look at other people's business, why they insert themselves in other people's gardens? Because they have malice, because they don't like to see other people succeed. Kolomar li'inyaneim shel acherim, sha'al yidei zeh yidmeh she'omer shelaman tovatam doresh, v'zerak kidei sheyuchal levaker ma'aseihem ladunam l'ra. And many times people say, oh, I want to help out that person, so give me some juicy gossip about what they're up to so that I can find out something about them. Ulohutzisi nato aleihem, so that he can find something to incriminate and hate them further. V'zeh karmi sheli lo natarti. And that's what happens, is as a result of inserting oneself into other people's business, you end up neglecting your own vineyard. Ratzit Rashi Tevot Kishalom. Bameshe ha'adam mesiach dat me'atzmo v'inyanav, u'mefin libo li'iske acherim, nichshal v'nofel al yedei zeh rachmano litzlan. That by inserting yourself in other people's business, by being a gossip and a gadabout and a social butterfly and always needing to know what everyone else is doing, you forget about your own needs. You forget about to tend to your own garden because you're so obsessed with what other people's gardens are like. And this will be the cause of your downfall. So just to summarize, there are three ways of looking at this pasuk. You can look at it as a reflection of the national state of the Jewish people in Galut, like the Midrash. You can look at it as the occupational hazard that is the warning to the tzaddik, who says that even though you're doing God's work, be careful. Because while you're out saving the world, you could somehow have a fall from grace on your own and lose your spiritual status. And the third interpretation is more cynical, that there are people who insert themselves in other people's business maliciously, and as a result, they will suffer a downfall for having neglected their own affairs because they want to see what everyone else in the world is doing. And of course, the fact of the matter is that we know, at least using the second interpretation from Rav Zevul Falevi of Zhytomyr, that it is virtuous for a tzaddik to try and save and help other people. That's what we should all be concerned about doing. But the Medrash is telling us that there's a danger inherently in trying to help others. If I try to save the world and I'm not carefully watching my own spiritual level, I could have a downfall. And that's really what Hillel says when he says, "Im ein ani li mili uchashani la'atzmi ma'ani." He says, if I'm not going to be for myself, then for whom will I be? And when I'm only for myself, what am I? Which means I have to, there's no one else who's going to take care of me if I don't take care of myself. I have no excuse if I incur some kind of downfall because I was focusing on others. But if I only focus on myself, then what am I? What purpose have I really served in this world? All right. So now that I've given you this background of what the Pasuk in Shir HaShirim is really referring to, let's take a look at how it relates to our parsha. Vayihi kasher yalda Rachel et Yosef. So it was after 20 years in being in Laban's house. And Yaakov has built up a family with his wives, Rachel, Leah, Bilha, Zilpa, and Yosef is finally born. It's been now 20 years that he's in Laban's house. Vayomer Lavan, Yaakov Lavan. So Yaakov turns to Laban one day and he says, Shalacheni ve'elecha el mekomi ula'artsi. Please send me so that I can go back to my home, back to my land. Kima'at asher haya lecha lefanai v'yifrot zarev. Consider, Laban, how little you had when I first came here. And now, because of me, everything has become so blessed and plentiful. Ve'ata, and so now, matai e'ese gam anochi leveti. When can I do the same for my own household? When can I do the same for my own household? I've been working for you for 20 years. I've built up your estate. I've amassed great fortune for you. When is it going to be my turn to create my own family, my own land, my own wealth? The Zohar says in source number 7 that that's exactly what this pasuk in Shir HaShirim is referring to. Samuni no teira et akiramim dichtiv, hayiti bayom, achalani chore v'kerech balayla. That I have been placed as the watcher of the vineyards. And that's what Yaakov meant when he said that I have been watching out in your fields. I have eaten a chorev and kerach at night. It's been cold. There's ice in the middle of the night. And I've had sleepless nights just going out to make sure that the crops are growing properly. Karmi shali lo natarti. I haven't been able to plant my own vineyard. When can I go ahead and take care of my own field? And so the Zohar says that the source for this pasuk in Shir HaShirim is Yaakov Avinu himself. And I love this quote that I found from a sefer called Bitzur Yarum from Harav Yoram Abergel. And he says, the language that he writes is beautiful. He says, Adam tzarich litzok et hatza'aka hanokevet. Every human being has to cry this penetrating cry. Mataya ese gam anochi leveti. When is it going to be time for me to do that for my household, to take care of my own household, to take care of my own affairs? Kol hazman ha'adam ose lema'an ha'achirim. Person's whole life is doing for others. Lema'an ha'esek, lema'an ha'mishpacha. He's working for his business. He's working for his family. Aval matai ha'adam ya'ase leman atzmo. But at what point in one's life can one say, I'm doing this for me, for my own self-development? Kimosha darash Rabbi Akiva v'cheyachicha imach. And he says, you know, the famous teaching of Rabbi Akiva, your brother has to live together with you, which means chayecha kodmim l'chayecha vercha. As the Gemara in Bava Metzia says, that if two people are traveling in the desert, and one of them has a canteen of water with it, and he'll need to drink the entire contents in order to survive. Rabbi Akiva teaches that your own life takes precedence over the life of your fellow that you're traveling with. So you have to drink the water before the other person drinks. It's almost like the analogy, you know, when you're in an airplane and they tell you, should there be a loss of cabin pressure, the oxygen masks will fall from the top of the plane. And if you're traveling with a small child, be sure to put on your own oxygen mask before you put on your child's. And let me just use that illustration, this idea of matai e'ese anochi gam anochi leveti. You know, we in the Jewish community spend our lives justifying working for others almost as a diversion. First, when we're young, we go to yeshiva, we go to school, and we are dutiful for the sake of our parents. And then when we start to become somewhat adults, we may get a job and we may feel that we have to impress other people. So we do the things that we're supposed to do to win popularity and favor from other people. We then get married and we build homes and we have children. And we start dedicating ourselves to religious and spiritual affairs for the sake of our children. So we work hard to pay for their tuition and to put them through school. But there does need to come a point where I have to look at myself in the mirror and say, I've tended to so many other people's gardens. Have I actually taken care of my own garden? Have I actually tended to the spiritual needs that I feel that I need in order to be able to be a proper Eved Hashem, a servant of God who is faithful and is growing spiritually and is attaching himself to the Almighty? A lot of times we can go through a lifetime of being part of a religious community and look back and realize how little time we've actually taken to tend to my own garden. So busy have I been, so preoccupied have I been by taking care of others that I've allowed myself to get distracted with, because it's so much easier to take care of someone else when my own garden needs tending. It was Yaakov's courageous act of essentially saying to Lavan, I've had 20 years of this distraction of being able to develop and grow in your home. But now I realize that if I don't make my move now, then I will have lived a life where I have never taken care of my own spiritual needs. Yaakov could have lived a full life in Lavan's house, and he lacked for nothing. But his desire to leave was a result not of his need for physical wealth, but to be able to become his own person and grow up to be the person that he was destined to be all along, Yaakov Avinu. There was not too long ago, we had a guest from the Orthodox Union visit our community. And the president of the OU is a guy named Moshe Bain. And he told us that there seems to be evidence that a number of our day school children, after attending 12 years of grade school, are dropping out of Orthodoxy. And it's very alarming, because what do you do? I mean, what do you say to a parent who has spent literally hundreds of thousands of dollars to yeshiva day school education, only to have it so proverbially flushed down the toilet because after all of that time, the young man or young woman leaves Yiddishkeit? But he noted something interesting. There seems to be data to support the notion that if a parent models Yiddishkeit properly for their child, then the dropout rate decreases significantly. That is, if a father or mother shows their love of genuine love of Yiddishkeit on their own, for their own sake, not for the sake of just providing it to their child, that they genuinely enjoy learning. The parent genuinely enjoys doing mitzvot and going to minyan and so forth and so on. Then the children won't just think that school is something that mom and dad want them to do, but rather it's what mom and dad believe in for themselves as well. And so Judaism is given extra weight in the children's lives. There's a benefit to atam matai eseh gam anochi leveti, because it's the most genuine and it's the most real. So that's the first thing that I wanted to leave you with for tonight. Before I go on to the second part, are there any questions or comments? Let me just look at the chat here for a second.
There's the one question on if you want to address on Moshe's family. Moshe Rabbeinu obviously spent time with others. Maybe that's a big exception, but I don't know if you saw that from Ariel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you're right. Moshe Rabbeinu is a great example of someone who completely devoted his life to the tzibur, and he paid the ultimate price for it. And there are rare individuals. This is the general rule, but there are rare individuals, perhaps one in a generation, where they can actually justify sacrificing their own children on the altar of Klal Yisrael, where they can actually justify and say, yes, my children, I know that they're going to suffer, but I have been chosen of God to be able to do something that is far larger than my own family. Usually that person has to have some kind of prophetic message or some indication that they've been chosen. Moshe was given that task by the Ribono Shel Olam. He divorced his wife also, and that's certainly exceptional behavior, not something that we would expect a regular person to do. I don't think anyone in this generation or generations within the last 1,000 or 2,000 years could ever justify abandoning the welfare, the spiritual welfare of their own family for the sake of the holy work that they're doing for the sake of the general community. Does it happen? Occasionally it does happen. The Gemara therefore even comments, don't forget the exact quote, but that it's quite common for the child of an Am Haaretz to become a great scholar, and it's common for the child of a great scholar to become less learned. For that reason is that sometimes those who are Oseik B'Tzorchei Tzibur, yes, on the one hand, they have a Havtacha, they have a special promise from the Ribono Shel Olam that their children will be protected, but at the same time, there is a price to pay. I'm sure anyone who speaks to children of rabbis will be able to tell you that there is a sort of a common trauma that these children all face. Rabbi Kelman, you have any experiences, or can you relate to that?
I mean, thank God. I mean, I know research on children of rabbis. Thank God. I think we had a wonderful upbringing, and me and my brother and my sister were all love Yiddishkeit, and we saw a great model in our parents. But I don't know what to say. But yes, I know there's some children who run away from the rabbinate. Their fathers are rabbis, and they want nothing to do with it. And other people, they love it because their parents became rabbis. They become rabbis.
Right. And so it's to your parents.
That's what happened to me and my brother, you know? And so anyways, Rav Daniels, you do not come from, but I will say, since you asked me, you know, we have today a phenomenon, I think it's pretty recent. You know, many of the great Rabbanim do not come from rabbinic families at all today in this generation, last generation. You know, it used to be, I think, you know, look at the families. It was sort of the child after the father. And today you have children, there's parents. I mean, I think Jonathan Sacks is a wonderful example. He really did not come from a learned family at all. And anyways, that's enough. I'll let you add in your comments as somebody who deals with a large, large congregation.
Yeah, no, that's, you know, there's definitely, my children I know have paid some price. I don't think that they've been overly or excessively traumatized, but there's always a price to pay when you're tending to a much larger flock than your own family. Okay, I'll leave it at that. Anyone else wish to comment or before we go on to the next topic? Okay, so let us go back to our handout. Okay. So we are, I just want to share with you a very terse statement by Rav Chaim Attar, who is one of the classic commentaries in the Mikraot Gedolot Chumash, at the end of last week's parasha, at the end of Parsha Toldot. Rivka tells her son, Barach lecha el Lavan, go and flee to my brother Lavan because your brother Esav wishes to destroy you. And so why did Rivka feel that Yaakov should go to her brother Laban? So the Or HaChaim says something very, very terse. He says, Ki hu ya'amod neged Esav im yelech lo hargech. Because your brother will not be able to go up against Laban. Laban will protect you. My brother Laban will protect you if Esav tries to go up against him. Now, when you think about it, Lavan was not the most savory person. He was not a particularly honest person. Rivka knew what her brother Lavan was like. She grew up in that household. Why did she feel so confident that Lavan would protect Yaakov? I mean, Esav had amassed great wealth as well. And Lavan, we all know, was always interested in making deals with people who could increase his wealth and power. So what would have stopped Esau from making a treaty with Laban to deliver Yaakov to him? So where do we see this Rivka confident her Laban would protect Yaakov? So that's something that I want you to think about before we launch into this midrash. This midrash, I learned this earlier in the week with another group from my own shul, and we looked at this midrash, and it is so rich with the imagery of just treacherous behavior that goes far beyond the ruse that Laban, the trick that Laban played on Yaakov. There's multiple layers of deception that are taking place throughout Laban's life, not only between himself and his son-in-law, but also between himself and everyone else, it seems. And the Medrash makes a point of this, and it says, "Vayeesof Lavan et kol anshei hamakom vayas mishte." Then when it came time, Yaakov asked Lavan for Rachel's hand in marriage. Lavan assents. He says, fine, we'll make a big simcha, we'll make a big chasana, we'll make a big party. And the Torah says, "Vayeesof Lavan et kol anshei hamakom vayas mishte." Lavan gathered together all of the people of the place in Aram, and he made a party. Now, there's something unusual about the words of this verse. He gathered all the people together and made a party. So my question to you is, what do you do first? Gather the people together and then make the party? Or do you set up the party and then get the people to come so that the party is already going? And so this is what Chazal pick up on. It seems like the order of this pasuk is somewhat malformed. He shouldn't have gathered the people together and then wait for them to set up the party. The party should have been set up before he gathered his guests together. So the Medrash says that based on this unusual phraseology, it says kines kol anshei mekomo. That really what this pasuk is alluding to is that Lavan gathered together all of the people in his neighborhood. Amar lahem yodi'im atem shehayinu dichukim lamayim. You know that before Yaakov came to our neighborhood, we had a water shortage. The Kaven Shabbat Tzadik Hazel Lekan Nit Baruchu Hamayim. Once this righteous man came to our neighborhood to visit us, all of a sudden a bracha occurred in the water supply. We know this from other midrashim that when Yaakov came to the well, just like as what happened with his mother Rivka, when she came to the well, the water moved upward to greet her. So too, when Yaakov came to the well, once he removed the big stone, the big rock off the well, the water came up to greet him. And from that point onwards, everyone felt that there was a special bracha in their environment after Yaakov came along. So Amarin lay, Uma'ahani lach. So they said to him, okay, good. So what can we do about it? How can we help you in what you'd like to accomplish to continue this blessing? So Amar Lahon, in Bayin Atun Ana Mirameve. So he says, if you will participate in the deception, I would like to deceive Yaakov so that I can get him to stay longer with us. V'yahiv le'leyad hu rachim lahadar rachel sagei. And my plan of deception, Chevra, he's speaking to the entire crowd of people, is I'm going to give him my daughter Leah in marriage, even though he really wants to marry Rachel. And what do I hope to accomplish? By having him marry Leah first, he'll have to work 7 years for Leah, and then an additional 7 years for Rachel. And that way we'll get him at least for another 7 years. We'll have multiple more years of blessing. So Amrin Le Avid Mai Dahani Lach. So the townsfolk said to Lavan, sounds good to us. If it works for you, it'll work for us. But he said, but I need your participation. I need your cooperation. Amar Lahon, Havuli Mashkon Deleit Chad Minichon Mefarsein. So he said to them, but you need to give me something of value to guarantee that you'll keep your mouth shut. In other words, what Lavan said, I can only pull this off if not one of you who comes to the wedding between now and the wedding says a word to Yaakov about what my plan is. And they said, well, okay, we won't say anything. No, I don't trust you. Give me a bag of grain, each and every one of you, or some other item of food that is of value. And if you don't spill the beans, you'll get it back. But if you spill the beans, I get to keep whatever you give me. V'yahavun le mashkonim. And so everyone gave him something of value, some food item of value. Va'azal va'ayte aleihon chamar meshach v'kofa. And that's how Lavan made the party. So Lavan may have not had the wherewithal to make a lavish chasana, but he came up with a master plan. Let me collect some food from each one of my neighbors as a way of, as a security to make sure that they'll keep their mouths shut. And that's how he was able to get all the food to make a party. So that explains why the pasuk says, Vayesof Lavan et kol anshei hamakom, that Lavan first got everyone together, and then he made the party because he took food from every single person that he gathered together from the village. So Hevei Lama Nikra Shemo Lavan Ha'arami Sherima Be'anshei Mekamo. And that's why he is known as Lavan Ha'arami. Not only does the word Arami, when you jumble the letters, spell Ramai, spell the word that means deceiver, but it also means that he didn't just deceive his son-in-law, Yaakov, but he deceived all of the other fellow Arameans, that he was cunning and figured out a way, figured out an angle to be able to influence them to give him stuff. V'kula yoma havu mechalalin bei. So as they were leading up to the wedding, let's say, was called for 5 p.m. So they have the whole Kabbalah's Panim, they have the whole reception, the whole day. They're praising, singing songs of praise to Yaakov. The cave in the old Biramsha, Amar Lahon Mahu Kidei. And finally, it comes time. They've done all of the Lachayims, and they've sung all the songs, and evening is coming. It's time to get married already. And they're not stopping. They're continuing to sing and praise and laud. And Yaakov says, come on, Chevra, it's enough already. Why are you heaping this praise upon me? Amrin le, at gamalt chesed bizchutav. Because look at all of the blessing that we have because of you, Yaakov. We appreciate you. We love you. V'hayu mekalsin kadmoye, v'amrin ha laya ha laya. And they kept praising him and lauding him. And then they couldn't resist. It was almost like they were snickering because they knew that they had a secret that they were keeping from Yaakov. And they said, like, halaya, which could be read as hallelujah, right? Praise the Lord for giving us you, Yaakov. Or it could mean, hilea, hilea. It was their code for saying, look, Leah's coming, Leah's coming, meaning we know the secret that it's really Leah and not Rachel. So look how insidious this is. Everyone in that party of 100 or more people is in on this trick against Yaakov. This innocent bacher is the only one in a crowd of hundreds of people who is just totally being snookered by everyone in the town. It reminds me of, there was a scene in a movie where Clint Eastwood was the only one in the room who didn't know that the mushrooms were poison. What movie? I don't remember the name of the movie, but it's one of those scenes where everyone else knows that you're doomed except for you yourself. That's what the Medrash is portraying. So it's love on deceiving and tricking his neighbors. It's the neighbors participating in the deception. This is like Yaakov has entered into the lion's den of deception. Biramsha aton ma'alata, b'chafon botzinai. The Medrash then continues and it says, so at night arrives, they go upstairs, they're escorting the chasen and kala upstairs to the bridal suite, and all of a sudden, everyone blows out the lights. Every single candle is blown out. It is completely dark. Amar lahen mahu kidein. So Yaakov says to them, what's going on? It's pitch black in here. Amri leh, ma'at savur, da'anan dichrin dichvat chon. So they say to him, What do you think? That we are a bunch of male rams, male sheep, just like you. In other words, we're not animals. You're an animal, as the commentaries to the Medrash say. When you first met Rachel by the well, you went ahead and gave her a big kiss in front of everyone. We're modest people. We don't do that. You're about to go to your bridal suite. Of course, it has to be pitch black. So here you have an example of people who are the height of deceit, tricking Yaakov, participating in this ruse that he's married the wrong woman, and then they position themselves, they posture themselves as holier than thou, as saying, "Oh, we're not like you, who would we are modest, we are chaste, we are good people, not like you." B'chol ha'hulelia havatzavach lo Rachel. The whole night that Yaakov and Leah are together, he lovingly cries out to her and says, "Rachel, Rachel, v'hi anyale." And she responds. Whenever he says Rachel, Leah responds. "V'tzafra v'hine hi Leah." In the morning, as the pasuk says, "Behold, it is Leah." "Amar la ma ramyata bat rama." So Yaakov says in amazement, "Ma ramyata bat rama, you are a deceitful one, the daughter of a deceiver. How can you do this to me? Lav belel yahava karena Rachel va'at anetli. How could you do this to me? The whole night I was calling out Rachel and you were answering, but you're not Rachel." So amrale, eat sapar delet le talmidim. So she said to him a phrase, a very poetic phrase. She said, "Tell me, my new husband, do you think the barber has no apprentices?" Meaning that if you have a skill, don't you think you're going to have apprentices to learn that skill from you? Didn't your father call out and cry out Esav when it came time to give out the brachot? And you responded, though you were not Esav? Adkan ha-midrash. That's the end of the midrash. The Midrash teaches us a number of fascinating different images in this Midrash that I find particularly fascinating. But this last line, I mean, first of all, the fact that there's so much deceit running throughout, that's endemic, that's pervasive throughout the entire communal structure, is this deceit. And Laban is able to convince and to corrupt everyone in the village to participate in this deceit against him. But at the very end, what the Medrash is almost telling us is that as justifiable as Yaakov's deceit could have been in taking the blessings from his father Yitzchak in last week's parsha, look at the results. There are some commentaries who say, quoting earlier texts, that Esav actually sent a letter to Laban. Going back to her original question, what about Esav's interaction with his uncle Laban as well? Esav sent a letter to Laban and he said to him, "The young man that you are taking in stole the blessings from me by masquerading." And Laban shared this information with the rest of his family and perhaps even used it to justify how they could deceive Yaakov as well. And if that's the case, then deceit begets deceit. As justified as Yaakov was to have taken the brachot, and many of the Mefarshim say that the brachot had to be given through deceit because Yitzchak had to say the words, "Hakol kol Yaakov ahayadayim idei Esav," the voice is the voice of Yaakov, and the hands are the hands of Esav, because that was a prophetic statement that would grant the Jewish people both the voice of Jacob and the hands of Esav when necessary. And other commentaries say that on a more esoteric level, that Yaakov used deceit in order to, in some way, do a tikkun, do a repair to the deceit that was presented to Adam and Eve by the serpent, which caused them to sin in the first place. And when you use deceit in order to garner blessing from God, you in some way rectify it and elevate it. But however you're going to understand that story, there is fallout, even when you can justify behavior which involves deceit. Eventually it will come back to haunt you. Eventually it will come back And what this Medrash is indicating to us is that it came back to haunt Yaakov. And he had to accept that this was a direct product of his deceit of his brother Esau, his deceptive act. So some of the Mefarshim explain that how did Rivka know that Laban was going to protect Yaakov, even though she knew that it was possible that Esau would communicate with his uncle Laban? It's because, as the Medrash points out, Laban recognized almost immediately when Yaakov came to the neighborhood how everything changed because the tzaddik came to the city. And Laban had every vested interest in keeping Yaakov with him as long as possible. Because look how the world has changed when Yaakov the tzaddik is in our midst. And she knew, Rivka, she knew how greedy her brother Laban was. He's not going to want to do anything to compromise Yaakov's presence. He's going to want to make him his son-in-law, and he's going to want to keep him in the neighborhood as long as possible. So Laban will do everything to stave off Esav's attack. Laban, my brother, will protect you. Not for your sake, Yaakov, but for his own sake. So just another idea that I thought might be of interest to you is that we have to be careful how we deceive and when we deceive, even if our intentions are noble. But we have to realize that sometimes we get so entangled in that web of deception that eventually it comes back to bite us on the other side. Okay, any questions or comments?
Anybody would like to unmute themselves and ask a question? Bevakasha, they can. Yes, deceit never works.
That was very beautiful. Very interesting.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
I love the sin'ah, the Rashi table there, because the first well that Yitzhak dug was sitna and failed, maybe for the same reason.
Maybe sitna. Yeah, very good. Very good.
That was discussed a little bit last week. Rabbi Whitman was talking about the wells that Yitzchak dug and the names, etc. And the interesting, he quoted a totally different context, the Or HaChaim also. 2 weeks in a row that there is a little bit of a focus on the Or HaChaim, which is kind of interesting. It's not, I don't think that he's quoted quite as often as many other commentaries. But thank you for that. Okay, anybody else have any questions I'd like to ask? Bakasha?
I have a question. When Yaakov, at the end, when he wanted to get his wages, and he said that, you know, he'd get the spotted sheep and the striped sheep, was that a form of deceit because he took his rods to make sure that all of the sheep were spotted and speckled?
It depends how you understand that story. There are many different ways of understanding that. What Yaakov was doing was a deception of a deceiver. In other words, what Laban did, at least according to one way of reading the story, is that he took out of the flock all of the speckled sheep so that any time these animals would procreate, there was almost guaranteed that they would not beget speckled sheep because all of the sheep that were adult sheep that were speckled were removed. And as a result, he felt that what Yaakov was asking was not going to result in very much at all. He figured, okay, maybe there'll be a mutation among a few goats, a few sheep here and there. But what happened was, is that Yaakov knew that he was entitled to much more. And as the way that Yaakov portrays the story to his wives is that an angel came to him and told him that that's exactly what he needs to do, that he needs to do this because in so doing, he will leave Laban with tremendous wealth, but will be compensated in what he deserves to be compensated, which he never would have gotten from Laban. So again, it may be a form of deceit, but it's the deception that has to be done fair and square, meaning that there was no lying that Yaakov did at all. He made a fair bargain with Laban. Laban didn't realize that Yaakov had the ability to increase the odds of having the sheep being born a speckled sheep. And in the end, Laban was unhappy, but it was a deal that was made fair and square.
Rabbi Klopfen?
Yeah.
I have a question to ask you. So if we understand that, and correct me if I'm wrong, if Yaakov was trying to undo the deceit of the Nahash, and if we follow that parallel, the Nahash is almost at the beginning of time, was there some deceit that the Nahash was trying to undo, and what could that possibly have been?
I don't know that we can say that the Nahash was trying to undo someone else's deceit, unless we say that the Nahash was created by God for that very purpose. The Nahash was put in the world to allow for deceit to come into being in a world that is filled with pitfalls. And the Nahash represents the pitfalls of this world that give man free will. But at the same time, man, in the guise of Adam and Chava and Adam and Eve, succumbed to an evil form of deceit. And the way that the Shem Yishmuel and some of the other esoteric commentaries explain it is that what Yaakov was doing was taking that trait of deceit and elevating it for something laudable, for something beautiful and good that would result in something beneficial to the world. Deceit is one of those things that objectively is most of the time bad, but a very small portion of the time is justifiable and actually results in good. If I'm a guest at someone's house and they ask me, how does this soup taste? And I don't lie, then sometimes that actually results in something worse than when I do lie. So there are times when deceit is necessary, or deceit actually results in goodness. Now, can the deceit result in something that's unfortunate, such as the host saying, well, if you like it so much, I insist on you having a second helping, and then I have to eat the horrible soup some more? It's happened. But nonetheless, deceit does beget deceit, but sometimes it's unavoidable. Sometimes it's necessary.
Are there other, excuse me, are there other occasions where the deceit is someone says an angel told me, when really they're talking about their own abilities or their own willingness to act? And I'm thinking of the angels talking to Yaakov, which we just, or his claim that there were angels talking to him. We have no proof of this other than he said it.
Yeah, it's a very good point. I mean, it depends how you understand those psukim. I'm not really sure. We'd have to go into a deep analysis of those psukim, but it seems like when the Torah describes what he actually did, there is no angel speaking to him. And it's only when he repeats the story to Rachel and Leah, his wives, that he said that an angel appeared before me. We do have other examples of where the narrative changes, where a person takes credit for doing it themselves when actually it was told to them by someone else. But here it's where Yaakov changes the narrative, where he did something of his own volition. And then he says, God was the one who told me to do it by an angel. It could be that there's no contradiction. It could be that the fact that Yaakov knew to do this, he must have come to the realization that this was not something that I would normally have figured out on my own, unless God had planted this idea in my mind. Maybe that's what he meant to say to his wives.
Okay, it's 9:30. Unless there are any emergency last minute questions, Vakasha. Otherwise, Rabbi, thank you. We look forward to learning with you again. Always a pleasure to have you. And thank you very much. Next Thursday night, Rabbi Bram Weinberg, the rabbi of Kemp Mill Synagogue in Silver Spring, Maryland, will be our giving on the Parsha Shiur. Sunday morning, 11 a.m., Rabbi Menachem Liptai continues with his series, and Mark Shapiro on Monday, etc. Through the week, we'll keep you posted. We look forward to learning with you. I want to wish everybody a Shabbat Shalom. Be healthy, be well, and we look forward to learning with you and to invite your friends to come and join us. And have a wonderful Shabbat. Shabbat.